Morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is Janet Charlton. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Lehman Capital. This is an appeal of the trial court's draconian order dismissing a foreclosure action with prejudice and releasing the mortgage lien from the property secured by the mortgage, resulting in a windfall for the estate's heirs. And in this case, there was no issue that some sums were due and owing under the mortgage.
There was an offer of judgment filed, right?
Yes, there was, Your Honor, for $116,000. This was a reverse mortgage in which, instead of advancing a lump sum and then the borrower paying back monthly installments of principal and interest, it was a mortgage in which amounts are advanced each month to the borrower, and when the borrower either dies or sells the property, the amounts advanced over the life of the loan are then repaid. The borrower passed away in March of 2003, and the loan was not paid off after she died, so this foreclosure action was filed in November of 2003 with an answer filed in May 2004.
Let's cut to the chase for a minute.
Certainly.
Can you tell me what, if anything, in the record would support a conclusion by the trial judge that your client intentionally disregarded the discovery rules or any order that he entered that would cause him to enter what he characterized as the harsh penalty or remedy of dismissing the action and striking the mortgage?
Your Honor, I had been unable to find any. The only conceivable grounds that I saw was on May 4th, trial was continued, and although the record was not clear, I believe Judge Bradley made a comment that it was because the witness didn't make appropriate travel arrangements, and my understanding is it was a mix-up, but other than that, as the record reflects, my client produced documents well before even a motion to compel was filed.
To their attorney?
To their attorney, correct. And somehow the attorney's office left the files in their computer and did not know that they had them. There is nothing in the record to show that my client knew that there was an outstanding motion for discovery, that documents had not been produced, and nothing to show that my client instructed the attorney not to produce documents until they gave permission.
When I read the transcript and I read the briefs, I get the feeling I'm missing something, because it certainly looks like the trial judge focused on your client and didn't look at what may have happened in Mr. Barnett's office. Can you remove from my speculation about why he ruled the way he did?
Your Honor, I cannot. I was not the attorney of record in the court below. I, like yourselves, read the record and was frankly puzzled. And our briefs reflect the fact, and we have gone through all the chronology. I ordered the entire trial court file from the court below, and I couldn't find anything to support that. In fact, there was really no outstanding discovery after the motion to compel on November 5th. There were never any motions for a rule to show cause when these documents weren't produced. There was no motion to extend the discovery deadline. No depositions were ever noticed, deuces tecum or otherwise. There were two pretrial stipulations.
There was the one deposition that your client's then attorney's office got notice of, and then because of an accident, as I understand it, he didn't find out about it till the day before the deposition. And that, as I understand the briefs, even that notice of deposition was filed by the other side outside of the discovery closure date. But there was one deposition, and it didn't take place, right?
Correct. The discovery cutoff was November 30th. I believe that notice of deposition was filed May 23rd of the subsequent year. So it was clearly outside of discovery cutoff. The record reflects that Mr. Barnett was out of the office because of a car accident when he returned on June 8th, and the deposition had been noticed for June 9th. He found out about it, I guess couldn't get the witness up from Virginia on a day's notice, called Mr. Cosgrove. They appeared on the 9th, obviously, without a witness, but the record reflects Mr. Barnett offered to produce a witness the week after, which would have been about a week and a half before trial. And even though both parties were available, Mr. Cosgrove's brief says, I believe, after due deliberation, he declined the offer.
Ms. Charlton, let me ask you this. It appears from the trial judge's opinion that what What concerned him the most was what he termed an intentional violation by your client of a court order to produce certain documents. I think your response to that is that, number one, the documents were produced at least to the attorney, and number two, there was no court order in effect at the time those documents were produced. That is to say, you know, that inference might have been correct had the had there been a failure to produce after the order was entered.
Perhaps, but even then you need to have willful conduct on behalf of the party.
Well, that's what I'm getting to. Let's just forget for a moment, put to one side that there was an incomplete, there was a delivery of documents to counsel, but not a second delivery to the other side. Take that out of the equation. A motion is filed to compel. The court in November issues an order directing production. Nothing happens for 9 months. I don't know what the record shows as to why nothing happened for 9 months. At the very least, one would argue counsel for the other side, that is, counsel at the trial level, had to know that there, that he was under an obligation to have his client respond to the order, yet that wasn't done. Would not that failure justify an inference by the trial judge that there was an intentional violation of a court order?
On the behalf on my client's part? That,
well, certainly on behalf, certainly on the lawyer's part.
But my client had no idea that the maybe I'm not understanding your hypothetical.
Take your client out of the picture. Let's just talk about the lawyer.
Mr. Barnett?
Yes. Did Mr. Barnett intentionally violate a court order?
I don't believe so, because if you look at the record after that, including the pretrial stipulations, it appears from the record that the estate decided to craft their relief not to continue to request the documents to have a defense, but simply to preclude evidence that they didn't get because they didn't get the documents.
Aren't we speculating, though? The fact is an order was entered directing your client to produce documents. Those documents were never produced. Whether your client did or didn't know that order, at the very least, Mr. Barnett did, correct?
Yes.
Therefore, the judge would have been, trial judge would have been justified in drawing some adverse inference, at least as far as Mr. Barnett was concerned. Is that right?
He may have been, but the...
I mean, so isn't your, isn't the key question then, whether that inference is attributable to your client as well as Mr. Barnett?
No, for two reasons. One, because under Rule 37, it specifically addresses a difference between failures to produce by the client, and the court also takes into account if the attorney is to blame as opposed to...
My question is, isn't that the issue?
No, and because the pretrial stipulation took away the discovery issue. At that point in time, it's our position that the estate dropped their request for the documents, because in the pretrial, both pretrial stipulations and both pretrial conferences, they did not continue to press for the documents. Instead, they represented to the court they're ready for trial, and the way we are going to address that issue is to preclude the appellant, Lehman Capital, from producing any evidence to support their claim for other charges, i.e., court. We are,
well, the court didn't know that, and nobody moved to vacate the order. So as far as the trial court was concerned, there was still an order outstanding which had not been complied with. And if it is correct that the person responsible, at least at the first level, for not complying with that order was Attorney Barnett, then the only question is whether the failure, whether it's intentional or not, by the attorney can be attributed to the client. Correct? If it can be, then you lose. And if it can't be, then you don't.
Your Honor,
me what's wrong with that analysis, because we're trying to figure out what the issue is here.
I believe Your Honor has a premise that if the failure is attributable to the attorney, then we lose. I don't agree with that premise.
No, I'm saying that's the issue. I'm not saying that's the outcome.
I don't agree that that's the issue, only because there were two pretrial stipulations of record filed with the court where the estate seems to drop its request for the particular discovery.
Well, how do you explain the motion in limine dated June 9th that says, paragraph 6, the defendant has been prejudiced in its ability to prepare for the trial due to the plaintiff's failure to provide discovery as requested by the defendant and ordered by the court and to timely identify the witnesses which it intends to call at trial. Plaintiff has failed to provide critical documents and account information to the defendant. These items have been requested by the defendant and ordered to be produced by the court. Plaintiff has failed to timely identify the witness intends to call. There were no witnesses identified in either pretrial stipulation, and the witness that was identified for the first time on May 2nd at the deposition, plaintiff's witness didn't appear, and so on. There's been no waiver of the court's original order requiring the production of those documents. Has there? I mean, doesn't that refute your argument?
No, Your Honor, and the reason why not is because there was a previous motion in limine filed on May 2nd, and in the previous motion in limine filed May 2nd in anticipation of a May 4th trial date, the estate did not ask for that relief. The only relief that they asked
Wait a second. So you're saying we forget about the June 9th motion because there was a prior one that didn't include the same allegations?
The only relief, yes, because the reliefs months, the estate is not continuing to ask for the documents or informing the court, by the way, I haven't gotten these documents, I still need them. In the May 2nd motion in limine, all the estate asked for, which is consistent with the pretrial stipulations, is that because we didn't get the documents, all evidence of these other charges should not be considered by the trial court.
Well, let's give it a slightly different slant, if you will. Wasn't there supposed to be a deposition shortly before the May trial date? And that's the deposition where Ms. Federspiel didn't show up, right?
That was an improperly noticed deposition, yes, Your Honor.
And it turns out that she's no longer the witness that the plaintiff was going to rely on anyhow. Now, wouldn't it be fair to say that after waiting all this time, not getting the documents, finally being told that Ms. Federspiel is the person who's going to have the information, having her deposition scheduled, whether it was properly noticed or not, and having her not appear, then the defendant says, I've had it. You know, I've been trying and trying and trying to get this information, and now I've found out that the one witness you've identified isn't even the witness. I'm filing this motion asking the court to take some action here, and that's what he did on June 9th. And you're saying that this motion has no validity because it wasn't in his prior motion?
Because he wasn't trying and trying and trying. He did not notice a 30B6 deposition within the discovery deadline, which he could have done. Please produce the witness that you intend to have testify as to the substance of the mortgage and produce documents.
What I think I'm hearing you say is that the defendant asked for discovery. The plaintiff had an obligation to respond and didn't. The defendant then got an order requiring the discovery. Plaintiff had an obligation to respond and it didn't. And because the defendant didn't just keep pounding you every month and say, you know, where is it, where is it, where is it, it's okay to just ignore that.
Well, I disagree that because the defendant didn't keep it, he did more than just not keep pounding. He basically crafted his relief to not need the documents anymore. So it was reasonable to assume by January 3rd, when we had the first pretrial stipulation, when the estate says there are no issues, we're all ready for trial, that he no longer needed the documents for his defense.
Let me follow up, if I might. I thought that I had thrown you the proverbial softball when I suggested that the issue, at least from a trial judge's point of view, is who is responsible or who should be deemed responsible for failing to comply with the court's production order. I understand that you're saying that's not a legitimate issue, but you and me assume that it is. What would be your line of argument that would exonerate your client from liability,
that
or responsibility?
We produced the documents. It wasn't willful. If anyone refused to produce them, it was the attorney, who admitted that he did have the documents in his office, discovered them on June 16th, and when he found out he had them, he forwarded them to Mr. Cosgrove.
So it's basically blame the attorney but not the client.
Yes, because it negates the willful conduct of the client.
Okay.
You want to reserve the balance of your time?
Yes,
please. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Martin Cosgrove, and my firm, Warren Rutt, represents Sudler Laughlin, the defendant below, and the appellee today. First, I would like to thank this honorable court for the opportunity to present this case to you. It's truly an honor to appear before all of you this morning.
We'll let you rethink that in a few minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me get started with your pretrial stipulation, where you state in paragraph 8, in the brief statement of the defense, that you acknowledge that you owe the principal and the interest on the date of the first request by the defendant, but that what's in issue is the amount of interest owed after that time. And you state that the plaintiff has refused to provide a payoff in formal accounting. What were the facts on which you relied for making the statement that they refused to provide it, and what do you believe the trial judge thought was evidence of an intentional and willful disregard of the court's discovery order?
Regarding the statement that they've refused to provide it, there's a timeline that was set forth in my brief. It starts on October the 23rd of 2003, where David Rutt, my supervisor, wrote a letter to Lehman Capital prior to the entry of the trial attorney, Thomas Barnett. Mr. Rudd advised the bank that Ms. Monroe had passed away and that he requested the payoff amount on the loan, as well as all these other charges that they were adding in addition to the principal and interest on this mortgage. They ignored Mr. Rudd's letter after Mr. Barnett's entry into the case, and when he filed the first complaint that was not properly served, Mr. Rudd wrote a letter to Mr. Barnett, again requesting the same information. That request was also ignored.
Well, what I'm asking you is, your pretrial stipulation characterizes as an affirmative refusal to provide the payoff in formal accounting. Did you represent to the court, either by a characterization of the email that you found out about that was sent by the bank to Mr. Barnett's secretary but never apparently got beyond her to Mr. Barnett, other than those two statements, what is the evidence that the bank refused to provide the information?
The fact that we had been requesting that information in excess of 2 years, or approximately 2 years, Your Honor, and they had never responded to it.
Well, in the pretrial stipulation, in paragraph 6.
I apologize. Which dated pretrial stipulation is that?
The one in the appendix, page 11.
Tab 11.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The tab 11. Tab 11. I'm corrected. Page 22. It says, plaintiff will call an employee to testify as to the payment history of the loan and the amounts now due. That name will be provided when received by counsel. That doesn't sound like somebody who's refusing to give you the information. It sounds like somebody who doesn't yet have it. That didn't turn out to be the case, did it?
Well, it appears from the email, Your Honor, if you, and I guess there's different ways to read it. However, the way that we have interpreted it, and I feel that the trial judge interpreted it, was
did he see it?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. And
is your contention that that's the basis he used to conclude that it was an intentional and willful?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Barnett, we did not see the email until it was the morning of the trial, and that was June 23rd of last year. And Mr. Barnett broke the email out when he pulled out the two attached pages to the email, which I believe are court exhibit number two, which is little half-page spreadsheet summations of the costs, and that's what they were answering our discovery request with.
Was there ever any interim sanction beyond granting a motion to compel?
The motion to compel was granted. In each of the pretrial stipulations, Your Honor, we did mention, and the court referred to the one in paragraph 8 on tab 11. On the second pretrial stipulation, there was similar information put in there that the plaintiff below had failed to or refused to provide that requested information.
Well, there's a difference between failed to and refused to. That's what I'm getting at.
I would say my characterization of refused, Your Honor, was that so much time had passed and they had not done it that I had interpreted that as a refusal.
Okay, what was the – did the court ever consider a sanction short of an outright dismissal of a case where you filed an offer of judgment and admitted that there's no contention about the principal amount of the mortgage and interest up to a certain point?
My recollection, Your Honor, there was not an interim sanction. I know that I had – in passing in Georgetown, Your Honor, said things to Mr. Barnett or when I talked to him on the phone on another matter, mentioned my outstanding discovery. That's not contained in the record, Your Honor.
No, I'm not talking about a sanction short of what the court characterized as a harsh remedy. Dismissing the action and striking the mortgage.
The only prior sanction, Your Honor, was when Lehman's witness failed to appear for the May 4th trial date. There was costs assessed against the plaintiff on that date. That was the only prior sanction against the plaintiff below, Your Honor.
Did you ever request any sanction other than limiting the evidence that would be produced at trial on the day that both sides were scheduled and ready to go to trial?
No, sir.
Where did this dismissal sanction come from? It wasn't requested by you.
I believe it was, Your Honor. I filed on June 9th. On behalf of the defendant below, I filed.
You asked for a laundry list of sanctions,
yes,
which started with limiting the evidence and ended with dismissing the case with prejudice.
It contained all of the sanctions available under Rule 37, Your Honor.
And when all the dust is settled, I think there's no disagreement by anybody that the effect of dismissing the action with prejudice is that the borrower here doesn't have to repay money that she or her estate agreed was due and owing.
That is the net effect.
That's a windfall.
It is a very harsh result, Your Honor, as the judge characterized it.
And to justify that harsh a result, there has to be some fairly extreme behavior on the part of the client. Would you not agree?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
What was it?
I think it's
distinguished from the attorney.
Yes, sir. I think it goes back to the timeline where
there was... Give me a bullet answer. What was the conduct that was so severe as to justify that harsh assessment?
I don't think it was one item, Your Honor. I think it was, again, and not to give you a drawn-out answer, but there was a timeline, and the trial judge, Judge Bradley, had this case the whole time. We had two office conferences. There's no record. There was no court reporter at those office conferences, but there was a discovery request back in June 29th of 2004, rather. The defendants below did not watch the calendar to the 31st day regarding responses to discovery, and a letter was written by Mr. Rutt on August 31st. Advising Mr. Barnett that his discovery was delinquent and we would file a motion to compel. I filed a motion to compel in October that was ultimately heard in November.
That is a drawn-out answer. It doesn't ring with any – I mean, the way it comes across, it sounds fairly soft. You know, what was the outrageous behavior that justifies such a harsh result?
The outrageous behavior, I believe, was that the email, which by our reading of it, advised Mr. Barnett not to turn over this information.
Until the fee issue was resolved.
Until the fee issue was resolved.
And which it was, correct?
Well, Mr. Barnett, in one of the transcripts, Judge Bradley asked him directly, did you ever receive notice from your client to go ahead and distribute the information? And his answer was no.
Well, he didn't know that he was to expect something from his client because he hadn't seen the email, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But he was asked by the court, did he ever receive authority to release the information, any information that was contained within that email? And his answer was no to that question. The missing of the trial date, and that was the May 4th trial date. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm missing something here. The email, I hope I'm not mischaracterizing it, read benignly says, before you go forward and send this information off and run up a bill, let me clear your hourly rate with whoever clears hourly rates within our institution. Now, at some point, wasn't it clear to Mr. Barnett that his hourly rate would have been cleared, otherwise he wouldn't continue to work for nothing for a bank? I mean, it's one thing to work for nothing pro bono. It's another thing to give your time to a bank. I don't know anybody that does that.
I think that's a reasonable assumption, Your Honor. And unfortunately, we don't have a crystal ball to see what exactly happened between Mr. Barnett and his client.
Well, we don't need a crystal ball to know that his secretary never told him that she had the information that had been forwarded by his client for the purpose of responding to discovery. That doesn't take a crystal ball. That just doesn't happen, right?
That's correct, sir.
Now, if the issue here is the presence of willful and intentional disregard of the court's order, whether it's by the lawyer or whether it's by the client, under these circumstances, how does one get to the point that these facts can be characterized as a willful and intentional disregard of the court's order rather than confusion within a law office and within a client's office about the extent to which the lawyer was keeping people up to date in the progress of the case?
My argument to that, Your Honor, would be that this bank is a sophisticated lending institution. This is their business. They know what information needs to be produced to their attorneys who are foreclosing on their mortgages. If the court would review the information that was provided in this email, it's two half-page spreadsheets with, again, all of these extra costs that aren't broken down or accounted for. And that...
Well, I understand your position is what they did produce may be incomplete for your purposes and would require massaging, either in one or both pretrial stipulations or in an office conference with the court. But that's not the issue. The issue is what facts support a willful and intentional disregard of a court's order that would justify dismissal of an action in which you'd filed an offer of judgment of over $100,000. Short of any other sanction that would be appropriate.
I think as the trial court perceived it, the email advising Mr. Barnett's office not to turn that information over,
Are you guessing at what might have been in the trial judge's mind? Because if you can point to me a specific finding of fact by the trial judge that justifies the conclusion that it's intentional and willful misconduct, it would be very helpful.
Yes, sir. If I could have
other
a second.
Than just a colorable statement that I can't tolerate intentional disregards of the court order, but a specific finding of fact that says this is what leads me to the conclusion that either the lawyer or the client or both intentionally disregarded the court's order.
Again, Your Honor, I think when Mr. Barnett pulled the email out, which was and the court has read this, it's kind of the end of this motions hearing. The judge just simply states that he can explain, meaning to the client, Mr. Barnett's client, that he can explain to the Supreme Court why he willingly and consciously disregarded the court's clear order to produce a critical piece of information in this case. The judge does not.
Well, he's not here to explain it to the Supreme Court. You are.
Yes, sir.
And I'm asking you, explain it to me, please. Other than the email and the fact that discovery wasn't timely filed, and I think everybody has to concede that. What are the facts on which the trial judge specifically found in order to justify the conclusion that it was an intentional and willful disregard of the court's order sufficient to justify dismissal of an action in which you filed an offer of judgment for $100,000 and have just conceded to Justice Jacobs resulted in a windfall to your client?
Again, Your Honor, I would go back to it's based on the totality of the circumstances that it happened in this case.
But that's what you draw. I'm asking you to tell me what is the specific finding that the trial judge made, other than a generalized statement that I'm really upset because a court order languished for 9 months, and my lawyer friend from Sussex might be at fault, but here's a way to hang it on the institutional client who's not going to be around next week, and here's my conclusion.
I would say that the willful conduct from on the part of the plaintiff below was their willfully failing to show for the trial. They were reprimanded by the trial judge. The issue, and it's my recollection that the issue of the discovery came up.
That was the transportation snafu, so the person who could testify to the accounting couldn't be there?
It was, Your Honor, it was a refusal to come from North Carolina to Delaware. When we had a teleconference with Judge Bradley, Mr. Barnett advised that the witness was in North Carolina and was not coming.
Where did the trial judge make that finding in the transcript?
Regarding the...
What you've just said.
I would say that that would be in his order, Your Honor, number 3, in his order, where he bases the facts that this order was entered because the plaintiff, number 3, failed to abide by the pretrial scheduling order regarding the trial date, resulting in the trial having to be rescheduled the day before the trial.
That was an order that concluded what? What was the interim sanction that resulted from that, other than a continuance? Anything?
There were some costs assessed against the plaintiff.
Okay.
For trial preparation on the defendant's side, Your Honor. Based on Judge Bradley's order, Your Honor, that he's hanging his hat or hung his hat on the failing to provide the financial information that was ordered under the motion to compel.
Until Mr. Barnett discovered that it had been in his office for some time and he didn't realize it.
Yes, Your Honor.
There was a 9-month gap between the entry of the order to compel and the discovery that there were, well, I guess the actual compliance, the delivery of the documents to your side. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
What was your side doing during all this time? I mean, were there phone calls made to Mr. Barnett saying, hey?
There were, Your Honor, and I had alluded to that before. There was a letter sent in January to Mr. Barnett advising him that he was overdue. And the point of the, I guess, the last motion that was filed for sanctions, that was not the goal, was to get this case thrown out. The goal was to get the information and follow our fiduciary duties to the estate and only pay what we were required to pay on behalf of Ms. Monroe to the bank.
Would you agree that your client would have been made whole, given all of the derelictions that took place here, by being required to pay no more than what it had offered in judgment and recovering attorney's fees for all of the procedural defaults that took place?
And Your Honor, I would agree with the court that there's no doubt that having the mortgage thrown out is a windfall, as we discussed earlier. However, with the amount that we felt was owed and our costs being assessed against the plaintiff.
As an economic matter, that would have made your client whole, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right.
It's been since 1987 since I participated in the preparation of a pretrial stipulation before a civil case, so I, with that caveat in mind. My recollection is if there were outstanding problems with discovery not being answered in a pretrial stipulation, that stipulation would reflect that problem and would suggest by each party what needed to be done in order to cure the problem. So both parties would know where each stood, and the court who got a copy of the pretrial stipulation would know what to look for in terms of setting a trial date. and make some estimate about whether those discovery problems could be resolved before trial so there could be a realistic trial date set. Is there anything in the pretrial stipulations that suggest problems that the defense had that needed to be cured by a certain date in order to be prepared for trial because of the dereliction in the plaintiff's answering discovery?
There is not, Your Honor.
Why not? Isn't that the purpose of the pretrial stipulation, set up the remaining difficulties so a realistic trial date can be set?
It is, Your Honor, and I'll be candid with the court. This was the first pretrial stipulation that I had ever prepared. I was in private practice for 3 months when I did this, so that neglectful act was mine, and I accept responsibility for not.
Well, I'm not characterizing it as neglectful at all. I'm suggesting to you that shouldn't it then be read that the discovery issues weren't as acute if they weren't taken care of in the pretrial stipulation as they're later characterized in your motion in limine?
I think it is in again, paragraph 8, which Your Honor cited, where the defendant does refer to the plaintiff's, and I characterize his refusal, to provide this information despite numerous requests by the defendant.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I would just like to sum up, unless Your Honors have any further questions for me. The appellant requests that the court remand this matter for appropriate proceedings to the trial court. The estate had all the information it needed a week before trial. The parties.
That's interesting that you want it remanded. I don't want to let that pass. If we were to remand it, what kind of instructions should accompany the remand?
That the order dismissing the matter be vacated and that the court consider what the appropriate sanctions should be for the failure to make the discovery and to hold the trial.
Well, this trial judge has already concluded what he thought the appropriate sanctions should be. Would we remand it to him, or would we remand it to another judge, or should we simply, if we disagree with what he did, enter what we think the record supports as an appropriate sanction?
I would welcome this court entering what this court seems to be an appropriate sanction if this court is inclined to do so.
Well, I don't know if the court will or not, obviously, but
we
the remand is
that.
Interesting. It's being remanded to a judge who has already concluded that this was an intentional disregard and entered an order not just dismissing the action but striking the mortgage from the record, which means, I take it, that the people who have purchased the property with the money held in escrow are sitting with the clear title, or at least sitting with the purported clear title with title insurance. I don't know what their status is, but what happens to their title if it's remanded and the mortgage goes back on the books?
Well, I don't know what the status of title is. You'd have to ask Mr. Cosgrove. I can only speculate that they have a policy that indemnifies them for the mortgage because the amount is being held in escrow. But I'm not going to speak for Mr. Cosgrove, but that is what I assume. So there would be no prejudice to the party who purchased the property because the money is sitting in escrow and available to satisfy the obligation. But to answer Your Honor's question, if this court is inclined to fashion a remedy for the discovery violations, I would welcome that. If this court is not inclined to do so, I would ask that it be remanded to the trial court and to a different trial judge, because clearly this judge has made up its mind about my client in an unfavorable fashion.
Anything else?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.